Chapter 11. Of all the Indians I encountered in my years on the plains, the most resourceful and intelligent, as well as the most dangerous, were the Sioux. They had the courage of daredevils combined with real strategy. They mastered the white man's tactics as soon as they had an opportunity to observe them. Incidentally, they supplied all thinking and observing white commanders with a great deal that was well worth learning in the art of warfare. The Sioux fought to win, and in a desperate encounter were absolutely reckless of life. But they also fought wisely, and up to the minute of closing in they conserved their own lives with a vast amount of cleverness. The maxim put into words by the old Confederate Fox, "Forrest, get there fastest with the mostest," was always a fighting principle with the Sioux. They were a strong race of men, the braves tall, with finely shaped heads and handsome features. They had poise and dignity and a great deal of pride, and they seldom forgot either a friend or an enemy. The greatest of all the Sioux in my time, or in any time for that matter, was the wonderful old fighting man, Sitting Bull, whose life will someday be written by a historian who can really give him his due. Sitting Bull it was who stirred the Indians to the uprising, whose climax was the massacre of the Little Big Horn and the destruction of Custer's command. For months before this uprising he had been going to and fro among the Sioux and their allies urging a revolt against the encroaching white man. It was easy at that time for the Indians to secure rifles. The Canadian-French traders to the north were only too glad to trade them these weapons for the splendid supplies of furs which the Indians had gathered. Many of these rifles were of excellent construction, and on a number of occasions we discovered to our cost that they outranged the army carbines with which we were equipped. After the Custer massacre, the frontier became decidedly unsafe for Sitting Bull and the chiefs who were associated with him, and he quietly withdrew to Canada, where he was for the time being safe from pursuit. There he stayed till his followers began leaving him and returning to their reservations in the United States. Soon he had only a remnant of his followers and his immediate family to keep him company. Warily he began negotiating for immunity, and when he was fully assured that if he would use his influence to quiet his people and keep them from the warpath his life would be spared, he consented to return. He had been lonely and unhappy in Canada. An accomplished orator and a man with a gift of leadership, he had pined for audiences to sway and for men to do his bidding. He felt sure that these would be restored to him once he came back among his people. As to his pledges, I have no doubt that he fully intended to live up to them. He carried in his head all the treaties that had been made between his people and the white men, and could recite their minutest details, together with the dates of their making and the names of the men who had signed for both sides. But he was a stickler for the rights of his race, and he devoted far more thought to the trend of events than did most of his red brothers. Here was his case, as he often presented it to me: "The white man has taken most of our land. He has paid us nothing for it. He has destroyed or driven away the game that was our meat." In 1868 he arranged to build through the Indians' land a road on which ran iron horses that ate wood and breathed fire and smoke. We agreed. This road was only as wide as a man could stretch his arms. But the white man had taken from the Indians the land for 20 miles on both sides of it. This land he had sold for money to people in the East. It was taken from the Indians. But the Indians got nothing for it. The iron horse brought from the East men and women and children, who took the land from the Indians and drove out the game. They built fires, and the fires spread and burned the prairie grass, on which the buffalo fed. Also it destroyed the pasturage for the ponies of the Indians. Soon the friends of the first white men came and took more land. Then cities arose, and always the white man's lands were extended, and the Indians pushed farther and farther away from the country that the Great Father had given them and that had always been theirs. When treaties were broken, and the Indians trespassed on the rights of the white man, my chiefs and I were always here to adjust the white man's wrongs. When treaties were broken and the Indians' rights were infringed, no one could find the white chiefs. They were somewhere back toward the rising sun. There was no one to give us justice. New chiefs of the white men came to supplant the old chiefs. They knew nothing of our wrongs and laughed at us. When the Sioux left Minnesota and went beyond the Big Muddy, the white chiefs promised them they would never again be disturbed. Then they followed us across the river, and when we asked for lands, they gave us each a prairie chicken's flight for weighs 160 acres. This they gave us, who once had all the land there was, and whose habit is to roam as far as a horse can carry us, and then continue our journey till we have had our fill of wandering. We are not as many as the white man, but we know that this land is our land. And while we live and can fight, we will fight for it. If the white man does not want us to fight, why does he take our land? If we come and build our lodges on the white man's land, the white man drives us away or kills us. Have we not the same right as the white man? The forfeiture of the Black Hills and unwise reduction of rations kept alive the Indian discontent. When, in 1889, Congress passed a law dividing the Sioux Reservation into many smaller ones so as to isolate the different tribes of the Dakota Nation, a treaty was offered them. This provided payment for the ponies captured or destroyed in the War of 1876 and certain other concessions, in return for which the Indians were to cede about half their land, or 11 million acres, which was to be opened up for settlement. The treaty was submitted to the Indians for a vote. They came in from the woods and the plains to vote on it, and it was carried by a very narrow majority, many of the Indians insisting that they had been coerced by their necessities into casting favorable ballots. Congress delayed and postponed the fulfillment of the promised conditions, and the Indian unrest increased as the months went by. Even after the land had been taken over and settled up, Congress did not pass the appropriation that was necessary before the Indians could get their money. Sitting Bull was appealed to for aid, and once more began employing his powerful gift of oratory in the interest of armed resistance against the white man. Just at this time, a legend, whose origin was beyond all power to fathom, became current among the red men of the North. From one tribe to another spread the tidings that a Messiah was to come back to earth, to use his miraculous power in the interest of the Indian. The whites were to be driven from the land of the red man. The old days of the West were to be restored. The ranges were to be restocked with elk, antelope, deer, and buffalo. Soon a fever of fanaticism had infected every tribe. Not alone were the Sioux the victims of this amazing delusion, but every tribe on the continent shared in it. There was to be a universal brotherhood of red men. Old enemies were forgotten. Former foes became fast friends. The Yaquis in Mexico sent out word that they would be ready for their great Armageddon when it came. As far north as Alaska there were ghost dances and barbaric festivities to celebrate the coming restoration of the Indian to the lands of his inheritance. And as the Indians danced, they talked and sang and thought of war, while their hatred of the white man broke violently forth. Very much disquieted at the news of what was going on, the War Department sent out word to stop the dancing and singing. Stop it. You could as easily have stopped the eruption of Mount Lassen. Among the other beliefs that spread among the Indians was one, that all the sick would be healed and be able to go into battle, and that young and old, squaws and braves alike, would be given shirts, which would turn the soldiers' bullets like armor plate. Every redskin believed that he could not be injured. None of them had any fear of battle, or any suspicions that he could be injured in the course of the great holy war that was to come.